This is number 0078, this Tough File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0078. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Ian Barnes, who is the producer-director of the film Wish 143, which is nominated for an Oscar in the category of Best Short Live-Action Film. What's this amazingly sweet little film about?
It's a kid, he's dying from cancer, and basically the wish man comes from a charity to grant him a final wish before he leaves this earth. And the wish that he wishes for is slightly more ambitious than the wish man could have ever imagined. I mean, the wish man was offering up the chance to meet star footballers, the chance to go to Disneyland, and our protagonist, David, he would like to spend an hour with a naked woman.
Stephen Paul Leyva is the author of Blood is Pretty, which has been turned into an audiobook narrated by Jonah Cummings. Both of them are on the show. What's it like for an author to hear their words come to life in audio form?
When you're lucky enough to get a book put into this form and you get an actor and a narrator as fine as Jonah here, you get a whole new perspective on it, and it's a lot of fun.
Kieran Mulvaney is the author of The Great White Bear. Are polar bears man-eaters?
As one scientist put it to me, you know, I guess people might think about them as these marauding kind of man-eaters. Give them half a chance. If you dress up in a seal costume and flop around on the ice in front of them, that's probably true. But as one scientist said to me, you know, it's a very great man-eater, they're doing a really poor job of it. Polar bear encounters with humans are relatively rare, and the polar bears often come off just as bad as the humans do that more often.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0078, is Phil Carpenter, who is a photojournalist with the Montreal Gazette newspaper here in Montreal. Thank you very much, Phil, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? Now, normally, I rail against the idiocy of people who put things on the internet and then complain about the consequences of their actions later. But in this one case, I have to side with the lady in question. 24-year-old Ashley Payne, a public high school English teacher in Georgia, had the good fortune of taking a European summer vacation. Now, afterward, she posted pictures of her trip on her Facebook page, one of which showed her holding a glass of wine and a mug of beer in a cafe in Italy. Again, she's of legal age, and she was on vacation and drinking in an Italian cafe, which, last I checked, is not a crime. Well, Ashley got called into the principal's office at her school and was told a parent of one of her students called to complain about pictures of her with alcohol. Payne says she was given a choice, resign or be suspended. The principal told her she must make a decision on the spot or he would go ahead and suspend her. Outraged, Ashley resigned, and now attorney Richard Storrs is fighting to get her job back. But here's the real troubling part. Ashley had used the privacy settings on Facebook and thought that the only ones who could see her vacation photos were her closest friends. She has also since learned that the original complaint came in as an anonymous email, not in a phone call from an angry parent. She is now in graduate school and is suing the district. She says she wants to be sure that the internet won't just record how Ashley Payne lost her job, but that she fought back. Good for you, Ashley. I hope to God she gets a ton of money. Personally, I think the only mistake she made was quitting her job. I would have let the principal suspend me, and during the time I was off, I could really show him the power of the internet and the media. You go, girl. Meanwhile, on to France. French police said they have arrested a 63-year-old woman who was leading her 40-year-old companion along a busy shopping street by a leash attached to his exposed penis. The couple were detained and are due to appear in court in April on charges of public indecency. The couple admitted to being sex addicts and say they were in the middle of a game when they were arrested. Gee, I wonder who won. Kind of curious. Meanwhile, a man in Adelanto, California, allegedly tried to carjack a van. It wasn't just any old van. It was a San Bernardino County Sheriff's inmate van being driven by a uniformed deputy sheriff. The incident began when the deputy, on his way to the jail, stopped at an intersection. Someone banged on the outside of the van, and the deputy got out to investigate. A struggle ensued. The deputy tased the suspect to get him under control and then arrested him. Leonard Baskerville, age 32, has a record of violent crimes. But he at least was efficient enough to choose a vehicle heading in his ultimate direction, or at least eventual destination. Good for you, Leonard. Okay, on to the other side of the world for this next story. You know, never mind the fact that there are a number of Americans who are still so thick that they don't think Barack Obama is born in the United States. Let's deal with the Russians, shall we? In a recently released survey, came out about a week ago, 32% of Russians believe the Earth was the center of the solar system and the sun revolved around it. 55% thought that all radioactivity is man-made, and 29% said that the first humans lived when dinosaurs still roamed the Earth. It's really quite amazing, said spokeswoman Olga Kamenchuk. She was talking about the survey in which 1,600 people were polled in Russia's various regions in January, with a 3.4% margin of error, by the way. All of the questions were absolutely obvious. The data speaks of the low levels of education in the country. However, people tend to forget what they've been taught at school if it's not part of their daily use, she added. Gee, how do you forget that the Earth revolves around the sun? Really? She goes on to say, I wonder whether our colleagues in any other country would find differences in their results. The study also found that women were more likely than men to believe in scientific fallacies. Gee, do you ever wonder sometimes how some of these people remember to breathe? Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, sometimes when you don't know the answer, it's best to just keep your mouth shut and remain dumb on the subject. 21-year-old Robert Mickelson of Farmington, Connecticut, had not learned this rule. He called 911 to ask the dispatcher just how much trouble he could actually get into by growing one marijuana plant. The dispatcher told him that he could be arrested, so he thanked her and then he hung up. A few minutes later, he answered the door, which, surprise, surprise, turned out to be the police. They arrested him after they found a small amount of marijuana and drug paraphernalia in the house. Mickelson has since admitted he bought the seeds and equipment for growing pot. Hey, pal, you know, that's why there's Google. That's all I'm saying. He almost made Idiot of the Day, almost, but not quite. That comes up later. Let's get to our first guest on the program, shall we, here on the Stuff File? The Academy Awards are just around the corner, and one of the films nominated in the category of Best Short Live-Action Film is Wish 143. The British flick is produced and directed by Ian Barnes, and Ian joins us on the line now. Hi, Ian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. This is a sweet little film, as well, describe it. Really enjoyed watching it. I understand that the story came to you in an interesting way from the writer.
Well, I wanted to do a short film for quite some time, so I put the feelers out. I reached out to all the writers that I know, and I couldn't find one that I liked. And then at a Christmas party, one writer introduced me to another writer who I'd never met before, a young guy called Tom Bidwell, and lo and behold, he had this amazing script.
And without giving too much away, well, first of all, I'll let you describe the story, which deals with a young man who's being treated for cancer, correct?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's a kid, he's dying from cancer, and basically the wish man comes, you know, from a charity to grant him a final wish before he leaves this this earth. And the wish that he wishes for is slightly more ambitious than the Wishman could have ever imagined. I mean, the Wishman was offering up football, you know, the chance to meet star footballers, the chance to go to Disneyland, and our protagonist David said that he would like to spend an hour with a naked woman.
Yes, he wants to be an adult for the first time before he goes, is basically one of the ways it's described. The thing I found interesting about the film is that it's a gentle depiction of the whole situation, and the characters are all played really well. Was it a difficult process to cast this film?
It wasn't. It wasn't really. I mean, the script is so powerful. I mean, it's such a good script by Tom Bidwell, who incidentally had cancer as a teenager. We drew up our list of first choice actors, and we aimed high. I mean, we aimed really high within the British scene. And all of them said yes. I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, we knew the script was special, but when you get actors of the caliber of Jim Carter, Rory Kinnear, Jodie Whittaker saying yes to this little short film, you know you've got something, you've got a hot potato on your hands.
Now, your film has also been nominated and won other awards too, and now nominated for an Academy Award. I bet this did not cross your mind at the time that you were making it, or did it?
It certainly didn't. I mean, there's no award higher, really, is there, on the planet? I mean, I thought that the script, I thought that what we produced, you know, would certainly have awards potential. And we did, like you say, we got the Audience Award at Palm Springs. We picked up some top awards in the UK. It's still out there doing the circuits at the moment. It's going to be in Jerusalem in July. But, you know, the Academy Awards, I mean, you know, it was a bolt out of the blue. It was just unbelievable.
Now, I'm here in Canada. You're from the UK. This show is heard throughout the United States as well. In Canada and in the UK, we tend to be a little more liberal when it comes to some of the entertainment choices and opportunities that we have to view. A little more conservative in the United States. The thing that caught my eye in the film, and I don't want to give anything away, but the person who kind of helps young David, that would raise some questions in the United States.
It possibly would. I mean, he's a man of religion, and he goes against his faith basically to try to help this boy who is dying from cancer. So, I mean, it is controversial in a way. But I think it's just touching, and the priest played by Jim Carter just feels so much for this poor boy, that in the end, you know, he decides that he will try and give a helping hand.
A short film, well done, very small budget, shot in a very quick period of time. It's almost like guerrilla filming in a way.
It is. I mean, we a four-day turnaround, a four-day schedule for it, which is really tight. I mean, my co-producer, Samantha Waite, did an amazing job pulling together all the resources that we need. We used a lot of friends on the crew. We pulled in all the favors that we had within the industry over there. So it was, it was tight. It was tight. I mean, we managed to get together about, I mean, it probably equates to about $20,000, which is, that's the hat budget on the King's Speech. So basically, it was a struggle, but I mean, we knew we had to make the script. I mean, as soon as we read it, myself and Samantha, we just knew it had to be made. And like I said, the actors were on board, the crew read it, they loved it. So we were very fortunate with the generosity of everybody who came together to make this film. So I hope everybody's incredibly proud that it has been nominated for an Academy Award, which is just surreal, bizarre, wonderful, amazing.
Well, speaking of the King's Speech, do you think you might be riding what could be a British wave?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it's hard to tell. I spoke to Tom Hooper the other day, the director of the King's Speech, at the nominees' luncheon, and I sent my congratulations. It's just a wonderful film. It is a wonderful film. I watched it in a cinema in the UK one afternoon with my girlfriend, and I mean, it's just so emotive, you know. I mean, the relationship between the two men, and also Helena Bonham Carter, just incredible writing, incredible direction, incredible acting. I just wish the best for, you know, the whole team. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed, you know, for Best Picture and Best Actor for Colin Firth.
As with your film, Wish 143, what does being nominated and potentially what will winning do for your career and those of the who worked on the film?
Well, I mean, certainly being nominated has opened many, many doors, especially in Los Angeles, which is where I am now. You know, the nominees luncheon was a couple of days ago. I'm just waiting to get a flight out. It's opening doors. You know, in LA, you need a manager, you need an agent. You know, there's a whole team of people who will assist you, help you, guide you. So, you know, that's certainly what it's helping with at the moment. I mean, we have scripts, we have ideas, there's stuff that we would like to pursue off the back of the short. So hopefully it will give the momentum, you know, to push us forward, really, and see where we can get in the future. Obviously, I'd love to do a full feature. It won't be kind of based on this story. It'll be there's other stories that we have, but, you know, I'm hoping that will... You know, the nomination will certainly help with regards to that ambition.
The sad reality about some short films, about a lot of short films, is that you don't necessarily, the general population doesn't get an opportunity to see them. How does one go about seeing Wish 143? And does the notoriety of being nominated and hopefully winning increase the chances that it will get a wider viewership?
Well, I know that it is going to play across the states. I think it's the next week or maybe the week after. I know. That a company called Shorts International that is very, very supportive of short films, I know has a nationwide tour. So I don't know whether it's probably possible to Google the film Wish 143 and just see whether it's playing, you know, in a multiplex near you or an independent cinema. But I do hope that, you know, that these shorts get out to people because, you know, I've seen a few of the competition that we're up against, and they're amazing. I mean, they're very, very strong. Incredible stories. You know, it's no surprise that they're all in the running for the Academy Award because they are so strong. So, you know, fingers crossed that, you know, when this tour happens, that people get to see it. I imagine eventually it'll be online as well and accessible online. So, I hope people see it and enjoy it.
Do you have an acceptance speech prepared?
Well... It's funny, we went to the nominees luncheon the other day, and what they do, they play a little tape of Tom Hanks advising you on your acceptance speech. And he's very clear, you know, he's, you know, keep it true, give it heart, give it humor, give it, you know, just explain the experiences and stuff like that. And don't read a big list of thank yous, you know, because, you know, for the viewing audience, that's pretty dull. What they have behind the scene is something called a thank you cam, which I believe goes out live on the Oscars website. So that's where you can sit with your list of, you know, 2,500 people and thank them one by one. But no, I haven't really thought about it yet, to tell you the truth. I don't like to tempt fate, you know. So, you know, maybe slightly near the time, I'll think about. Just, you know, putting myself in the mindset of possibly winning, which I'm not doing at the moment because, like I say, I don't want to tempt fate. But I've got a couple of thoughts bubbling away in my head. So, you know, hopefully I can make it memorable should we actually get up on that stage.
Well, we wish you well. The movie is called Wish 143, and I hope for you Wish 144 is an Academy Award.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And fingers crossed.
Ian Barnes, director of the film Wish 143. Keep your eyes peeled for this Oscar-nominated short film because it really is a sweet little movie and you should make an effort to see it if you can. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is show number 0078, and you'll find links to the BBC website where you can watch the film.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll introduce you to The Fixer, and we'll let you know all you need to know about polar bears. That's coming up, plus, of course, an idiot of the day comes your way as well, but right now, more Stuff File news. In Johnstown, Pennsylvania, 29-year-old Richard Brandon Johnson is having a tough time learning his lesson. He had only been out of jail for one day when he decided now would be a good time to rob a bank. A judge had released Johnson, who was awaiting trial on charges of assaulting his girlfriend. The next day, he allegedly robbed the First Commonwealth Bank shortly after it opened. He was arrested 2 hours later and also charged with stealing a Jeep. Gee, the term habitual criminal comes to mind here. I mean, some people just never do learn, do they? Okay, in Fort Myers, Florida, someone sent 9-year-old TJ Davis a lewd photo to his cell phone. And we'll argue the merits of a 9-year-old having his own cell phone later. For now, suffice it to say that the photo was of two adults performing oral sex on a couch. As soon as he saw it, TJ said, "This was too old for me. I wasn't ready for that," and ran inside and showed it to his mother. So his mother called the number the photo came from and threatened to call the sheriff's office. The guy at the other end apologized and said he had sent the photo to TJ's number by mistake. He had meant to send it to, and here's where it really gets good, someone who was interested in buying the couch, because that was the only photo of it that he had. TJ's mom said, "It's puzzling and belittling to me that you can sit there and say this is the only picture you can find to send to somebody advertising a couch." Now, that was desperate for a sale if he has to do that. And if you're still worrying about the 9-year-old with the phone thing, the family said they gave TJ a cell phone so that he and his sister could check in with the family before and after school. In the meantime, the Lee County Sheriff's Office is investigating, and the boy's cell phone has been turned over to the deputies on the case. Technology, you know, is making wrong numbers, or at least taking them, I should say, to a whole new level. A whole new level of wrong numbers. Okay, let's move on. Police in the southern Louisiana city of Houma say a woman upset over her lack of freezer space allegedly hit her boyfriend in the face with a frozen beefsteak. Police said 47-year-old Edith Tassin, also known as Edith Verdin, was booked with aggravated battery against 51-year-old Jerry Voisin. Now, authorities say she since has been released on bond. Police say Voisin called police on Sunday evening and told them that Tassin was trying to cool a mixed drink and became upset when it wouldn't fit in the freezer. Police said Voisin was bleeding from the right side of his face when officers arrived. Kind of reminds me of an old episode of, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, when sweet young Barbara Bel Geddes clubbed her husband to death with a frozen leg of lamb and then cooked it and fed it to the cops. Ah, good times. Now that's entertainment. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Stephen Forthman of North Knoxville, Tennessee, wears a T-shirt depicting a hand holding a gun and the words, "I don't dial 911. Well, that's apparently his real philosophy. When he encounters a problem, his first response seems to be to try and shoot it away. When his house caught fire and was completely engulfed in flames, firefighters found him in the front yard shooting his gun at the burning house. That's right, shooting his gun at the burning house. He was also screaming threats, apparently, at the fire. Police restrained and disarmed him. The house, by the way, was destroyed, not by the bullets, but by the fire. Apparently, Forthman didn't dial 911 on another occasion, too, when he had chest pains and tried to cure them by, wait for it, shooting himself in the torso. His brother-in-law saved him by getting the gun away and calling an ambulance. That's a clear misuse of a powerful painkiller, if you ask me. Someone should take his guns away permanently. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, or I should say guests, on this edition of the Stuff File program. Stephen Paul Leyva is no stranger to this show. He's been on with us several times. He's the author of the Fixer novels. The first one was Blood is Pretty, and the second one is Hollywood is an All-Volunteer Army. Blood is Pretty has just come out in audiobook form, narrated by Jonah Cummings, and both Stephen and Jonah are on with us now via the wonderful world of Skype-to-Skype communications. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Peter.
Nice to have both of you on. Let's start with you, Steve. We've talked about your book several times in the past. We talked about it in manuscript form. So what's it like now having it out as an audiobook?
Oh, it's a whole different dimension, and it's quite a delight because literature started as a verbal thing, wasn't it? Sitting around the campfires and telling stories and Homer and what have you. So every writer, or at least this writer, when he writes, he thinks of the voice. He wants to create a voice. And there's a voice in his head. But when you're lucky enough to get a book put into this form and you get an actor and a narrator as fine as Jonah here, you get a whole new perspective on it. And it's a lot of fun. You get to sit back and enjoy the warmth from the fireplace and immerse yourself in someone else's voice and his interpretation of your characters and what's happening. And when he gets dead on to what was in your head, you're delighted. And when he surprises you and makes something better than what was in your head, you're even more delighted. And that's the experience I had with Jonah.
Now, Steve, you're all the way in California. Jonah, you're on the other side of the country. I'll put this question to Jonah. How did you two guys hook up?
Actually, it was through the publisher, Crossroad Press. David Wilson had contacted me and asked if I was interested in doing a book for him.
Now, did you read the book beforehand, or was this just, voice for hire, as it were?
Usually I read the materials before I go into it as part of the research, read the complete book, and then I'll go back and actually highlight portions, the characters, different scenes within the chapters. If it's possible, which it was in this case, to talk to the author to try to get a feeling for the book and his voice.
Pardon the pun, is there ever a time when the two of you are not on the same page?
I was going to say I didn't think so. There were a couple of times where I wanted to make sure that I had a character down, that I was envisioning what Stephen had in his head in terms of the, a character and how that particular person should sound. Because narrators, you know, a lot of times we're asked, well, how do you remember all of these characters and what voice to do and that type of thing? And what I try to do is I try to actually visualize a character in my mind, their mannerisms, their personality. You know, I go a lot on the physical description that the author provides. There's a picture that comes into one's head, and it's very easy to drop into that character once that visualization takes place.
Now, Steve, your thoughts on, you know, taking your baby here, the book of Blood is Pretty, and handing it over to someone else. Now, again, you work in L.A., and you're used to this situation when something goes from either the printed word to the stage or the printed word to the screen. What's it like in this case for you?
Well, we worked closely through both email and chatting on the phone now and then. But the process was basically technical on pronunciations of words and things like that. And then every once in a while we would get into character. And Jonah and I had a discussion before he started about the different characters. And he asked me specific questions of what I thought of these characters and potentially who I had in mind, say if I was to cast it in a movie or something. And then he created his own characters. And like I say, on some of them, I'm sorry, the police are coming to get me.
I was about to say, are you being surrounded? Is that
it could well be. I shouldn't have taken that Mounds bar from Walgreens. But he would surprise me sometimes with his interpretation of a character. It wasn't wrong. It just wasn't what was in my head. And specifically, the character of Roey, who's sort of the fixer's Watson. And it really took me aback for a moment, and then I got into it, and now, of course, that's the voice of Roey. It absolutely was a interpretation of the character a little against the type that was in my head, but it turned out to be actually right, because the type that was in my head wouldn't have been proper for how I described the character in this character's past. And it made Roey more interesting, and also his voice for Roey made the byplay between Roey and Fixer, which sometimes comes into moments of what I call vaudeville, back and forth, little humorous bits, even funnier because of the quality of Roey's voice. So that was delightful. And another character, Petey, who's sort of like the character of Q for my character, the Fixer. He obviously works for a Secret Service agency back in Washington, and he makes things. And the Fixer, he's an old friend. He calls upon him and asks him to do things for him. And that I was very specific in that character that when he talks, he almost talks very loud all the time. And Jonah was able to adapt that very well. But then he had to come up to the point where there was one moment where Petey, who's a brilliant scientist, has to explain something to the Fixer. And it's a long explanation, and that can't all be shouted. But it's also where Petey is shown to be brilliant, where before he's been sort of a comical character. So Jonah took the voice that he created and brought it down a little bit, kept it Petey, but brought a new understanding of the character, which the Fixer comments on in the book. So emotionally, it worked very well. And the other thing I want to say is that I think I talked to Jonah about that a book like this, because it's in the first person, Fixer is the narrator of the book, it's not just a narration of that part, it's also a performance of the whole book. He's a character throughout the whole book, as well as the other characters as the narrator. And he did, I really love what he did with it.
Well, Jonah, as someone who does this for a living, who narrates books, is that a difficulty, doing a story that is told in first person?
No, actually, I prefer doing a first person narrative. I'm a big fan of the old detective novels. And a lot of times those books were written in the first person, where the protagonist was, you know, narrating the entire story. So this was fun to do.
Very quickly, Steve, give us in a nutshell what the plot of Blood is Pretty for those who hadn't heard when you were on the program in the past.
Well, it's my hero is called the Fixer, with two X's, as I always point out, to distinguish him from all the other fixers in life. But he basically works in Hollywood, and he works off Hollywood. He fixes the sins and the problems and the escapades of the Hollywood elite, and sometimes those in Hollywood who aren't the elite yet, but he's pretty sure they're going to be there. Because he charges a lot of money to do this, and when it's somebody that's up and coming, what he does is contracts basically to get a small percentage of their income for the rest of their careers. And he will bend rules, and he will bend the law to do that for them. It's mysterious as to where he came from, but you get the feeling that he's had a sort of a spy background. He knows how to do things. He knows how to con people. And he likes to live well. And this is how, this is sort of the profession he's fallen into. Now, but the key is, in each story, always something happens that riles up his sense of the moral. And he then he becomes your classic knight errant, and he's going to solve the problem. In this case, a young geek, film geek, who had written a treatment for a film that a director wanted to pay him off for and then get him out of the way and claim credit for. So the fixer was hired to go pay off this geek, and the geek wouldn't be paid off. Later, the geek winds up dead and dismembered, with the blood, the pretty blood, spread out all over his apartment.
Thus the title, Blood is Blood Pretty. Gotcha.
So the fixer's upset that his intervention in this, he's pretty sure, led to this kid's death. So therefore, he's going to not avenge it so much as to correct it and find out why this happened.
Okay.
And in doing so, he solves the problem.
Well, let me play matchmaker here for a little bit, because as I said, the first book is out, Blood is Pretty. Any plans, Jonah, to do Hollywood as an all-volunteer army?
Oh, well, I haven't been asked.
we'll have to talk to David, the publisher, about that.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. You know, I have not had a chance to read the second book yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
And one last question for you, Steve, and that is, you mentioned the fact that Jonah has brought different nuances to your characters. Does that affect, or will that affect, because as you know, I'm an evangelist for these characters that you've written, I've read both books and I love them both, if you write more in the future, does what Jonah has done, will that affect the fixer in the future?
I think that's inevitable. I think especially, like I say, with the character Roy, I don't think it would, as I'm writing it, that's just the voice I will hear now. But as the core of the character did not change, and Jonah captured that, then I don't think the core of the character that I created would change. So in that aspect, those are just the voices that'll be in my head, which makes it better for me, because at the moment the only voice in my head is me, and on occasion I can bore myself.
Well, tell me, Jonah, how does it feel to be a writer's inspiration?
Flattering. It's a joy to do these audiobooks, and for this particular novel it was fun. The characterizations that I had in my head for the fixer was sort of a mix of Jack Nicholson, with Roe, it was kind of funny at first, but you know, here's an ex-Mossad guy that's capable of killing you and then serving up a perfect souffle,
and he's gay.
And Anne Isley, a lot of times it's difficult, in the narration world, for men to do women and women to do men. But I conjured up, the characterization of a smart Marilyn Monroe.
Exactly.
Edgy for Anne Isley. So, doing all of these characters was a lot of fun, and it does help bring the book to life for me.
The book is Blood is Pretty, and very quickly, Steve, one can get it how?
Well, you can get it at crossroadpress.com and also springbrookdigital.com, available on both sites. Eventually, it'll be on Amazon because it'll be carried by audible.com, but it's not quite there yet. But directly from the publisher or from Springbrook Audio, and then I think other audio companies will pick it up. It just seems to be natural. It's deliverable as an MP3 for your iPod or your MP3 player, or to play on your computer, or however you would like.
Excellent. Steve and Jonah, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
author Stephen Paul Leyva and narrator Jonah Cummings. The book is Blood is Pretty, and it's available for $12.99 at Crossroad Press and at Springbrook Digital. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is show number 0078, and you'll find links to Stephen's blog and the previous sites mentioned. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones. Have you ever driven over a bridge in the winter and noticed that it was more slippery than the main road? Bridges ice up quicker than roads, so transportation departments place signs there warning us to be careful. Here's something you might not know, though. Even in states where the risk of ice is the same, the wording on these bridge signs is sometimes different. In most parts of the country, the signs say, "Watch for ice on bridge." But not in my state. An official here once told me that a driver who crashed on a bridge sued the state over the sign. The driver said that since the sign warned her to, quote, "watch for ice on bridge," she watched the bridge instead of traffic and crashed. Unbelievable. But the state changed all the signs, and now they simply say, "Bridge may be icy." Let's be fair, these types of lawsuits don't make us any safer. They just pile costs on taxpayers. And even worse, they reveal that America's court system can be trickier to maneuver than an icy bridge. Learn more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, "As a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse." Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, "Fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up?" If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about polar bears. And, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But I have some more Stuff File news stories for you right here, right now. In Sandusky, Ohio, 27-year-old Nicole Scott was so drunk while driving, she mistook the flashing Skate World sign for police lights. So she pulled over her black Dodge Avenger into a snowbank near the sign and waited for an officer to approach her vehicle. After some time, a passerby stopped to see if the woman needed help and called police after noticing she was wasted. When officers did arrive, they found Nicole sitting alone in her car but denied being the driver of the vehicle and said her friend Ray had been driving but he ran off. She refused a sobriety test because she insisted that she was not the driver, but then changed her story and said that her friend Samantha had been driving. Later, that changed to her friend Courtney had been driving the car, and after that, it was changed to her friend Brittany, who had been driving the car. Police found a half bottle of Michelob Ultra in the car and only one set of footprints near the vehicle. Nicole had trouble walking when she exited the vehicle and had to be helped to a waiting police cruiser where, yes, she was taken to jail for DUI. You know, what's scary is that there are more like her out there. Happy motoring. Redneck alert, redneck alert. Johnny Rice, age 35, eating at a Waffle House restaurant in Spartanburg, South Carolina, was charged in January with beating up two diners at another table over the quality of their conversation. A man and woman were discussing women with hairy armpits. Rice was assisted in the pummeling by two other diners, and weaponized food was involved. Redneck alert. Yes, indeed. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File program news, before we get to our next guest, as of early November, 150 people have been killed by the erupting Mount Merapi volcano in central Java, Indonesia. And the government had created shelters in stadiums and public halls for 300,000 jammed-together evacuees. By that time, however, some had petitioned authorities to open up private shelter locations so that the displaced could attend to certain romantic biological needs. Apparently, some evacuees had become so frisky that they had left the shelter and returned to their homes in the danger zone just so they could have sex. Wow. Did the earth move for you? Is that the heat we're generating, or is it molten lava? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? What do we really know about the polar bear? Well, they live in Arctic regions. Fully grown, they can measure 10 feet and weigh close to 2,000 pounds. And if you were to believe television commercials, drink Coca-Cola. So let's get our facts straight. Joining us now is Kieran Mulvaney, who is the author of The Great White Bear. Hi, Kieran.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So there's so little we do know about the polar bear. First of all, how do they differ, if at all, from other bears that we do know, the grizzly, the Cody, the Kodiak, so on and so forth?
The primary difference is, you know, that they're the only truly carnivorous bear. Other species like grizzlies, they'll eat meat. But they'll also eat fish, as we know. They'll eat vegetation. Polar bears, you know, you look at their teeth, you look at the way they're set up. They exist to eat meat. In fact, really to eat fat. There's one scientist who suggested that it should be called lipovores rather than carnivores because they exist really to eat the blubber of the seals that they catch out on the sea ice. And that's their environment, the sea ice environment.
Now, we do hear a lot lately about the polar bear because of the melting of the polar ice cap. So tell us a little bit about that. How endangered is their natural environment?
Well, their environment certainly is essentially disappearing beneath their feet. On average, it looks as if the sea ice extent, certainly the summer sea ice extent in the Arctic Ocean, is diminishing by about 11% per decade. Most scientists would project that at present we're looking at a seasonal sea ice-free Arctic Ocean by the middle of the century. No one's predicting that there won't be any sea ice in the Arctic in the winter, but the problem is if there's nothing in the summer, obviously it's going to take a lot more for it to grow back, and the winter expanse is going to be a lot less too. That's a big problem for polar bears. Polar bears need sea ice. They are creatures of the sea ice. That's where they walk, that's where they patrol, that's where they do all their living, and that's where they do their hunting. They feed on seal species that also need the sea ice. So potentially it's a very grave concern.
Now, this is not the first book you've written about that particular region. What is the fascination for you of the area?
You know, it's a strange thing. I've always been interested in the polar regions, not just the Arctic, but the Antarctic also. I've been fortunate enough to spend some time in the Antarctic. I lived in Alaska for several years and many times wish I lived there still. I don't know quite what it is. It is a stunningly beautiful, both of them in different ways, the two polar regions, stunningly beautiful environments. And I was working with a couple of folks, a couple of explorers who aimed and ultimately were successful at becoming the first people to make it to the North Pole in summer across the Arctic Ocean sea ice. And during their first attempt, they were stalked quite a lot by polar bears. And we ended up talking about them, about polar bears, and I realized that, you know, there's just not a lot of popular information out there about what makes a polar bear, what makes it tick. And so that's what I wanted to try and do with this book.
Okay, so what are some of the biggest misconceptions, if any, that we have about polar bears?
You know, that's a good question. You know, they're not, as one scientist put it to me, you know, if you know, I guess people might think about them as these marauding kind of man-eaters, you know, and give them half a chance. If you dress up in a seal costume and flop around on the ice in front of them, that's probably true. But as one scientist said to me, you know, if they're these great man-eaters, they're doing a really poor job of it. You know, polar bear encounters with humans are relatively rare, and the polar bears often come off just as bad as the humans do, in fact, more often. I guess that's perhaps the biggest misconception. Otherwise, I think it's not so much a misconception as perhaps even just a lack of information about them. You know, and it's something that scientists are doing their best to put together, but obviously they're extremely difficult species to study. I mean, they're in very, very remote areas, and there's only, you know, a few areas where they're able to study them in great depth.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that they can measure 10 feet in height and weigh close to 2,000 pounds, yet they start off very tiny, don't they?
that I think is one of the most fascinating things about them, and you know, why I kind of opened the book about that. It's just hard to imagine. You know, when they're born, they're about 20 ounces. A polar bear, your peasant polar bear, will, when it's time for her to give birth, she'll wander around, she'll start poking snowdrifts and look for a snowdrift that she thinks is ideal. She'll dig a little tunnel down into the snowdrift and then arc it back up again, make a very small den that's just about big enough for her, and lie down there and give birth. And, you know, shortly afterwards, the cubs come out, they're like 20 ounces, and the first 3 months of their life is spent in a snowdrift. You know, that's where they suckle, that's where their eyes open. Then not until they're about 3 or 4 months old that they ever see the sunlight, that they ever actually experience the cold of the Arctic at all.
Are they born in litters, or are they born one at a time?
The most common is two, sometimes three, sometimes one, but two is the most common.
And is it true that the polar bear is actually trying to keep cool, not warm?
They're so incredibly well insulated that that for them, even an incredibly hostile environment in the Arctic, is very easy for them to overheat. They can, you know, they've got a thick layer of blubber. They have, perhaps surprisingly, black skin underneath that fur, which also helps trap the heat. Their fur is hollow, which also allows it to trap air that can further warm. So they're just essentially these big, giant, furry greenhouses. You know, and they amble along, they walk a lot at a steady pace. If they have to pick that pace up even a little bit, they can very, very easily overheat. For them, it's a really big deal, is trying to keep cool.
So, again, with the melting of the polar ice caps, the situation where not enough ice in the summer, never mind the situation with the winter, is the warm temperature that melts the ice also a danger to them? Not just the loss of ice.
Sure. I mean, I think potentially, you know, the warm temperature, you know, can be a problem. I think probably the greater problem is simply going to be that because of the conditions that temperature rise creates, they're going to have to use a lot more energy to get the food that they need. They're going to have to swim a lot more, for example, to get from ice to ice. And there have been some recent studies that just go to show how incredible of a drain that is on a polar bear's energy to have to swim. They can swim, but they don't want to have to swim for too long. And so I think the big problem is going to be their energetic requirements. And that's why some of polar bears in some populations, for example, in southern Hudson Bay, some of them just, candidly, aren't as big as they used to be.
Speaking of swimming or traveling, they can travel great distances in the course of a year, correct?
It's an amazing thing that, you know, at this very steady pace, you know, they'll just wander and wander. Some Greenlandic natives call them a name, Pisiptuk, which basically means the wanderer, and that's what they do. And the extraordinary thing about it is that, obviously, you know, they're walking these thousands of miles across the sea ice every year, and of course the sea ice is moving underneath them as they're doing it. It's a little like living on a treadmill. And yet somehow, because they kind of seem to have these home ranges, they're always able at the end of the year to find their way back to where they started. It's an amazing thing that they wander thousands of miles. The area on which they walk itself moves thousands of miles, yet they still know where they are.
Fascinating creature indeed. The book is called The Great White Bear, A Natural and Unnatural History of the Polar Bear, and it's written by Kieran Mulvaney. And Kieran, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program.
Thanks very much for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
Kieran Mulvaney, author of The Great White Bear. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is 0078, and you'll find links to Kieran's website and either to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And of course, we have time for one more item, and that would be, yes, the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Despite what he apparently thinks, 27-year-old Jerome Smith of West Price Hill, Ohio, is not exactly a genius. He had been out of prison for just 2.5 months when he was arrested for allegedly striking a woman repeatedly on the head with a handgun. Oh, and she was pregnant. Oh, and he has the word genius tattooed in big letters across his forehead. Oh, and he misspelled it. He spelled genius with a J. Jerome, I don't even have to ask the question. I'll just state the obvious. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0078. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just check for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0078. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can check me out at Twitter and Facebook. You'll find me as P.A. Holder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags and mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.